Hey guys, it's Randy Gage, and you're listening to the Power Prosperity Podcast. Hey guys, welcome back. We got another episode. As you know, we're always looking at the principles of prosperity. And as you also know, I'm always beating you up to say, you got to learn how the money game is played. There is a system. There are these unwritten rules, and then there are the written rules, and then there are the ways it works in the real world. And I am joined this episode by a guest who knows where the bodies are buried. She is from that world. She's from the world of investment banking. She's recovering. She's written, I think, 3 books, including the latest and greatest, which is You Will Own Nothing. Her name is Carol Roth, and she's my favorite kind of woman because she's all about big hair and dangerous ideas. So, Carol, welcome.
Randy, it's great to be with you. And we have made you an honorary member of the Big Hair Club. We just, you know, because you embrace the ideals that we go after, we'll just grandfather you in.
Yeah, that's what I will need, to be grandfathered in. Although there was a day when I had big hair, believe it or not. So
I do. Are you like, you know, doing the full like 80s hair metal kind of thing?
Oh, yeah. I was so into that. Totally.
I could see that. Good times. Simpler times.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the book. But before we talk about the book, I want to talk about the reaction to the book, because it's been out a few weeks now. I think it's already a New York Times bestseller, so I know it's flying off the shelves. But you're shocking, bold, controversial. You're attacking some sacred cows in here. And I'm just curious, how have you been getting any blowback, you know, cancellation drama? Because I've been kind of off social media for a couple of months now, so I'm not really tuned into what's the latest polarization drama and trauma. How has it been received? Are you getting any of that kind of stuff?
So, sort of. First of all, as you mentioned, it did make the New York Times bestseller list, which was shocking to me. I couldn't believe, since they do a lot of shenanigans with their list, that they actually put it on. They did put it lower than other books that were released the same week that had sold many fewer copies, in one case, half as many copies. But I just sort of couldn't believe that they put it on. But then you read how they describe it, and it was like AI wrote it. It was like a person writes things about stuff. Like, they didn't want to tell you what was actually in the book. So I thought that was fascinating. I also think it's very interesting for the most part, because there are so many different ideas and so many of these that really are targeted at prosperity issues facing the middle and working class, that there has been alignment across the political spectrum. I have had great discussions with people who are super progressive, as well as super right, and all across that spectrum, because there are points of interest that we can all agree on. And I think that's something that's incredibly productive that has been absent for our society. So I think the idea that it's not this party versus this party, it's really, you know, the people who are working and wanting to seize the American dream and the people who are creating barriers to that, I think it's a sort of a different way to frame the, you know, the situation that's going on. I have had a few reviews that have, you know, it's clear that they didn't read the book, that they flipped through, they found the name of someone they didn't like in the book. And listen, I cited 600 sources plus, and most of them are corporate press, mainstream media, and some of them are from a political party that some people may not like, but those are few and far between. And again, it's about what they're saying, not whether or not you like the person. But I've been pretty impressed at, you know, the level of feedback and the fact that people really do want to get in on this movement to have more ownership and fight back against this nonsense that owning nothing is going to make you happy.
Yeah, I've been pretty fortunate. I have 14 books now, and the reviews, for the most part, I've been treated kindly. If they reviewed it, they've usually read it. And I know how unusual that is, just from my other author colleagues. So your New York Times thing, by the way, it might have been written by AI. I mean, there are so many writers and journalists now who are just using ChatGPT or one of the other ones for everything. I mean, it's right. Just crazy. So it really, I run a media outlet with a partner that we're launching. And he said, hey, I have a voiceover guy doing the email newsletter, and let's see, because I think people would like to get him by email. So I listened to him, I wrote him back, and I said, I don't think this is a real person. I think this is a computer generated audio. And he said, you passed the test. I was checking it out. I found this software and they do it. It was only $500. And so I thought, but you could just tell, you know,
right.
I was working on a video for a client, and same thing. I sent the agency the VO script and they sent me back the track. And I'm like, that's not a human reading that. They're, you know, I'm a writer by essence, right? So
right.
It's all about what's italicized, what's bold, what's the ellipsis. I need the emotion. So I write it so that they can, and that's right. What,
Your copy is full of soul because you're getting people to tap into that, to take action. It's not just about a series of words. It's about bringing those to life. And so if you have a soulless entity that is reading it, yes, it's chronologically correct, but you do miss that je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, for sure. So I think people are going to find it fascinating that there's a book about money, and the first chapter opens with like the COVID drama, the masking drama, the cancel culture drama. And I think people will find that really surprising. Like, why is a book about creating financial security talking about cancel culture? Can you explain what led you to do that way?
So I will tell you, so this is probably the first time I've discussed this, is that was actually the third chapter. I started with the history chapters first, but just like you were saying, I wanted to grab people and transport them into a story before giving them a history lesson and going back to the Roman and British and Dutch empires. So that was actually a calculated move that I made. But from a content perspective, so many people have been talking about social credit that's happening in China and their very formalized system that gives you letters and number grades based on your jurisdiction, based on whatever the CCP thinks is important. You know, go visit your elderly parents and you get good points. You know, cheat on video games, you get bad points. Say something bad about the government on social media and absolutely forget it. And just some staggering stories in there. The one I shared from NPR about a gentleman by the name of Lao Duan, who was a coal intermediary, who saw his fortunes change overnight when the government changed their coal policy. So he went from, you know, being very successful to bankruptcy, and they put him on this blacklist. And then what they did is they projected his picture onto this video screen. And it says, you know, his identification number, and this is an untrustworthy person. And, you know, you just kind of look at this and it's a scene out of Orwell, right? An Orwell novel. And as I'm thinking about these things and thinking about what we've been through in the past 3 years, and also kind of the trial by mob that's happening on social media and in our culture, I realize that people have been kind of focused on this from a free speech standpoint, but they haven't really been focused on the financial implications. And it tied into so many of these other areas that I was exploring with this underlying theme of creating barriers to wealth, that you owning nothing. So if you think about sort of the evolution of social credit. I put it from cancel culture to informal social credit. You know, it doesn't have necessarily a number grade, but there's the same kind of characters involved that help you or hurt you to this formalized system. And if you think about COVID, it was sort of the perfect example, because what it does is it goes after your social standing, it goes after your job, and it goes after your assets. So regardless of where people, and I'm not trying to change hearts and minds on this, I'm just telling you the financial reality of it. But if you didn't buy into the COVID narrative, if you didn't take a vaccine, if you didn't wear a mask, there were a lot of entities, whether they were government affiliated or individuals, who went after your social standing. Don't show up to Christmas. Don't go to Thanksgiving. You can't go to a restaurant once we open those by mandate. Oh, you're not wearing a mask at Trader Joe's. I'm going to take a picture and put it on social media and shame you. And maybe, you know, you'll lose some friends and some new opportunities. So those are all things that attack your social standing and your financial opportunities, where they come from. Then we saw the mandates that came out of the administration that basically said you had to lose your job if you didn't take a vaccine in certain industries. And many of those were the same industries where people had been deemed essential workers previously. They worked through COVID. They were the ones who were on the front lines. So, you know, if you were working in a healthcare organization, or you're a policeman or fireman or part of the military, you may have lost your job for noncompliance. And so that was your mandate. And then there were these coercive tactics for businesses where the government said, well, you know, if you're of this size, you have to do this. But if you're not, then you don't. But if you're a business, do you want to take on the risk of running afoul of the government and seeing what happens then? So there were a lot of businesses that kind of felt coerced to go in that manner. And so people lost their jobs. They lost their income. And then we saw the shutdown of businesses, particularly small businesses, by mandate, where they actually took your assets for some period of time and said, you cannot use these, you cannot earn a living, you cannot have value. Many people had to shut them down from that. If you are neighbors to the north, the Freedom Convoy truckers, you had your bank accounts frozen in concert with big tech. And, you know, these examples we're talking about are from COVID, but we've seen many people who've been deplatformed or lost their bank accounts, or, you know, so on and so forth. And it has these really significant financial implications. And then if you can't earn a living, how do you live? So I just thought it was important to kind of put this different lens on something that we kind of knew and kind of talked about, but really hadn't been viewing it in this kind of bigger macro picture.
I have friends in Colombia, and when the lockdowns happened, so I was like, well, so President Trump is throwing money from helicopters. They're sending everybody a check for $1,800. You know, what's happening in Colombia? I said, oh, no, they don't give you anything. They just say, if you leave the house, you will be arrested. You can't go to work. And hopefully you have food and hopefully you have money, because there is no safety net for those people. And that crazy shit in Canada, I mean, I did not have Justin Trudeau as a draconian, authoritarian dictator on my bingo card. I just would have never imagined that in the world. But
how about Chrystia Freeland? His second in command, who was also, you know, in charge, the finance minister there, who was really, from what I understand, the mastermind and certainly the public face of a lot of these things. So perhaps it, you know, it wasn't Trudeau who's sort of the, you know, hey, look at me, I'm pretty. Perhaps it was the other people behind him. But, you know, one of the things I did note in this book is that the same organizations do pop up a lot, which, you know, a couple times I'll say is a coincidence. And after the like 12th time, I can no longer say it's coincidental. But both Justin Trudeau and Chrystia Freeland are members of the World Economic Forum and were young global leaders. And if you go to that video from Klaus Schwab when he was at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government talking about this young global leader program. And then he said, and then we penetrate the cabinets. He specifically mentions at least Trudeau, perhaps Freeland as well, but they were both part of that program that he talks about in concert with this penetrating the cabinets, which from my perspective, penetrating the cabinets sounds a lot like penetrating the cabinets. Go figure.
Yeah. And maybe explain for people who haven't read the book yet, when you say you will own nothing, where is that coming? Because that's the theme through the book that you're fighting against. Maybe explain what brought you to that point.
Yeah, so I backed into it a bit. You know, I had all these different things that were going on where people were saying, I'm working hard, I'm saving, I'm investing, I'm doing the right things, and I don't feel like I'm getting ahead. I don't feel like I'm seizing that American dream. And I'm looking at all these things and I'm like, what's the connector? Like, what's the connector between social credit and central bank digital currency and Wall Street competing with you for a home and all these things? And then it just hit me with this "you will own nothing" meme that I had seen on social media. And probably like you, Randy, you know, the first time I see this going through the Twitter feed, I just assumed that somebody got it wrong or took it out of context or it was some kind of satire, because the World Economic Forum is littered with the business and political elite. So how could an organization like that be predicting the end of private property by 2030? That sounded insane. Took very little research on that particular front, by the way, to find it. You can see it on their Twitter feed right now. So it's 8 predictions for the world for 2030. It's with input from their global future councils. So some councils had input on putting this list together. And the number one prediction is you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. And several things struck me from that. First of all, again, trying to get people into the mindset of prosperity and, you know, wealth creation opportunities, spending more than a quarter of a century advocating for that. I know one indisputable truth: that wealth comes from ownership. You have to own assets, particularly assets that have the opportunity to at least retain their value, but hopefully appreciate in value. That's where wealth comes from. And so the idea that you have these people who are saying you're not going to have these wealth creation opportunity, you know, you get that weird antenna going up. But there's also something just in the structure of the language, and you being a writer and a student of words, I don't know if this struck you as well, but deconstructing "you'll own nothing and you'll be happy." The first half of that is "you'll own nothing." It's not "will own nothing." It's not an inclusive statement. It's not the people who are putting this out going, "oh, this is going to be all of us in this together." They're clearly saying that you're going to own nothing, and probably a different thing is going to be going on for them. So I thought that was kind of telling. And then the second piece is the "you'll be happy" piece of it. The psychological psyop to get you to buy into, oh, wouldn't it be a nice, relaxing life for you to have non-ownership and not have to worry about these things? Because if they can get you to buy into that and do that peacefully, they don't have to force it upon you, right? You just come along for the ride. It becomes a very easy thing. But we know that people throughout history who have not had property, who didn't have ownership, didn't have their property rights protected, they have not been free. They have not been happy. They have not been wealthy. Many of them have starved and many of them have lost their lives. So it's such an interesting, you know, seemingly simple prediction that I feel like is rich in so many things that deserved this highlighted attention, which is why then it became, you know, 100,000 plus words at the end of the day.
Here's the question for you. I remember watching Fox News, the Fox and Friends back, this is, I don't know, 10 years ago or something, and back when Obama was president, and they had two really vapid, just idiot women who were part of, there were two guys and two women, and these two particular one in particular who, you know, just like, you just feel like, okay, they're sitting there saying, okay, I know Rupert Murdoch is watching this right now, so what would he want me to say that's gonna get clickbait for the network and the rainy? And so they were railing about this crazy proposal called Obamacare. And she was like, and this administration seems to think that people want the government to cover their healthcare costs and pay for their prescriptions and their doctor's visits. And I mean, and I'm thinking to myself, has she ever met the average person?
Right. Yeah, absolutely. They do. Right?
Of course. You mean you can just tax more rich people and I can get shit for free? Sign me up. And of course, you know, for all that talk on how they were going to dismantle Obamacare, the minute the Republicans had control, of course, they did nothing.
About it. Nothing.
They had no alternate plan. And you couldn't, you'll never get it out of the government again. I mean, it will never be undone when you create an entitlement program of any kind, any government. You know, what people don't understand, you know, one of the things I try to point out in my work is that governments need you to be needy. Because if you're needy, you need the government. Organized religion needs you to be needy. The data sphere, the media, the social media companies, they need you fearful. They need you enraged because that's their business model. And so here I am trying to fight the forces of evil and tell people, no, take charge of your own personal prosperity. And, you know, you, I think, how do you feel like the consciousness is going? Do you think, so I'm saying, I mean, because I modeled the behavior, right? I have fuck you money. I just do. And I don't say that to be arrogant. I don't say it to be snarky. I mean, I've worked really hard and I've developed a body of work and I've created a lot of value that has rewarded me really well. So I'm financially wealthy.
Yes.
I can get canceled tomorrow. I wouldn't like it. It would restrict my work. And at this point, my work is more about getting out, expanding consciousness than I don't need it to pay my rent or buy cat food. I work because I love my work.
But it doesn't change your life.
Yeah. And if anyone in the world will get canceled, it would be me based on the sum of the, you know, when I take on government and organized religion and media companies.
Sure.
And, you know, obviously I'm a big target that a lot of people would love to shut up. But I'm okay with that because I've done the smart thing. I've been smart with my money and I own things in your parlance, right? I own assets that produce income. And some of them would certainly get restricted or even shut off completely if I get canceled, right? And there's worldwide boycotts. I don't know. But I still feel like there's a message, there's a market there for people who do want to take personal responsibility, who do believe, okay, no, you know, like I kind of lean libertarian, but I'd never put that label on myself. I don't want any label on myself.
God, you and I are like the same person. It's like you're in my brain.
I mean, I think, you know, I kind of like that the government has the highway system. And I kind of like that they have a standing military. And I like, so, you know, and I don't believe it would work if we said everything is privatized. Every school, every government function, the garbage removal, the water salination plant, the electric, you know, I feel like, okay, no, I think there is a role for government. I do think there is a role that the government could be a safety net. I'm not one of these militant people who never wants to pay taxes. And I'm happy to pay what I think is an equitable share of my income if it provides, because I do believe I get benefits from that. I've been very successful, but I had an infrastructure here in America that helped me do that, that in other countries they don't have. I could never do in Venezuela what I did here, because there is no, it's a failed state.
Right.
Afghanistan is a failed state. When you see failed states, you realize, if you live in Madison, Wisconsin, your idea of security is, hey, I may have $500,000 in my IRA. If you live in Afghanistan, your idea of security is having an AK-47 under your mattress in case the militias are coming to steal everything you own. And
which, by the way, both of those are good. I recommend
doesn't have
both.
To be either or. Yeah, so
I have an abundance mentality, Randy. I try to get everyone in on everything.
Yeah. So how are you? How do you perceive that attitude in the population, in the mass market, of people understanding or their beliefs about government and their beliefs about entitlement and their beliefs about taking personal responsibility for their financial security?
So I have become a student of human nature, because I think that tells us more about everything than any possible other thing. Like, you can't rationalize things that conflict with human nature. And again, it's why history rhymes and why we see the same things over and over again, because, you know, there are these consistencies. And I do believe in that meme that, you know, the hard times create strong men and strong men create good times and good times create weak men and weak men create hard times. And it kind of goes in that cycle. And so I think that one of the challenges that we have is that we have been at this global center of the financial universe for about 80 years. So for most of us who are living, we've known nothing else. We have lived through a period of incredible, unprecedented prosperity. We have incredible opportunities, great relative lives. And we can't see what came before us, and we can't see what comes after. And so, you know, we just have this knowledge of what's going on right now. And, you know, you can look back historically at a 50 or 100 year period over, you know, thousands of years, and it seems like a short period of time. But when you're in the middle of that, you know, that's a lifetime for people. So it's very hard to have context. And so some of the things that we know about human nature is that obviously there's some group of people like the two of us, and I would imagine the people who are listening to this, who understand the benefits of personal responsibility, that if you have rights, you need to have responsibilities with it, the abundance mentality, the opportunity, going out and seizing that. And there are a lot of people who have been told their whole lives that they are victims and that they can't attain things. And so if you tell someone that they're, you know, they have the opportunity, they're going to go seize it. And if you tell them they're a victim, most people are going to fall into that mentality. And so that's one of the things that's been done. We have really poor financial literacy. So, you know, we just saw this during the stimulus that you mentioned, whether it was the Donnie dollars or the Biden bucks, you know, people wanted to get their $1,800 or their $1,200. There are people like me screaming from the rooftops, "It's a trick. Don't take it. If you take that $1,000, $1,200, you're going to be paying $10,000 a year minimum for the rest of your life in increased prices." Well, I need to get mine. And so people don't understand things like, you know, currency don't just exist. They're proxies for something. You know, your dollar, they don't just make them up and they're valuable. It's a proxy for productivity and labor. And if you don't have additional productivity in and you print more money, you know, the ratio of that gets devalued. So people don't understand these concepts, and they don't want to make the small personal sacrifice, even for their own long-term benefit, without knowing that everybody else is suffering in kind. And so that's why you get these scenarios. I mean, look at what happened in France when they said, "We're going to raise the age of retirement from 62 to 64. They burned down Paris. We have people sitting in a cafe, like the most incredible images, with like the city burning around them, because people were so furious over a promise that was, you know, not realistic to begin with. And we have lots of those right now. You know, the liabilities at the end of 2020 were projected between unfunded liabilities and our national debt at that point in time, and it's increased since then, at $129.1 trillion. So given that, you know, the government only has so many things to do and taking away entitlements is not politically popular, you know, that does not bode well for direct confiscation of your wealth, your earnings, or the debasement of the currency, because those are the only levers they have. The government is not productive. They're not, you know, creating and adding value. They don't make their own, you know, real money that has anything that underscores it. So I think that this combination, human nature, people in power want more power. They want to keep themselves, you know, in play. Some people need direction. People don't want to give up their perks. You know, you just have this perfect storm that, you know, over some period of time gets to the point of no return. And we can see the signposts that we're getting closer and closer to that. We can see that on a debt to GDP basis. We can see that on the fact that the Fed has not kept the dollar stable here in the United States or on a global stage, that lots of countries are trying to de-dollarize and get away from the dollar, you know, because of that. So we have all of these like pretty clear neon signs, and you know, it's still not going to change the fundamentals of human nature. So I think that's one of the things that people really need to be tuned into. And then going back to kind of the where we started this, the other piece of human nature is that, you know, people show you what it is that they really believe. You know, you can listen to whatever they say that comes out of their mouth, but what are they doing? The people who want you to own nothing are not owning nothing. They're buying tangible assets. The people who are saying that there's a climate emergency, trademark, they are not getting rid of their oceanfront mansions. They are not flying their private jets. They are not eating steak dinners. They are not walking the talk. They're not acting like there's an emergency. So it's very hard to believe that there is.
Well, so I was listening to State of the Union, driving to my softball game last Sunday or the week before, and they had like two political leaders, one Republican, one Democrat, and they were showing their bipartisan cooperation for this debt deal and, you know, how things are still so rosy. And I think it was Dana Bash was the anchor that day, and she said, "But so how worried are you though about this deficit and the future?" And both of them had basically the same answer, which was, "Oh yes, we're very concerned about it long-term because, you know, we're going to have to fix this thing.
Because we won't be here long-term."
Right. But short-term, it's not a problem at all because we have come together. We passed this bipartisan spending package. We kept the government open. And I think they actually believe that. I think they, you live so long in Washington, D.C., you start to buy into that kind of tortured logic and thinking. And they really do think like, yeah, we're okay. I mean, main thing now is we got an election coming up in a year and a half. We need to make sure that there's no drama about this. So we came together, both bipartisan partnership, good of the country, yeah. Right? And, but how Social Security, I guess now would be bankrupt by 2032, according to most realistic estimates. Your book really kind of is, I don't want to say alarmist, but I'm going to say alarmist. Like you, if you read this book, you get the feeling, oh no, there's some really bad stuff that's going to happen quickly. What kind of timeline do you think we're on with this?
All right. So here's the thing coming from finance markets is that it's much easier to see trajectories than it is to be able to see here's the timing and here are the catalysts, because there's so many factors that are interwoven that can change. Any one change in a decision changes that whole chain of events. And also, you know, again, that this is a big behemoth ship that we're moving around. So it's like that, I think it was the Hemingway novel, you know, how did you go bankrupt gradually and then all at once? you know, that line, it's kind of the same thing where it's like, oh, this thing unravels gradually. And then all at once, we saw that in the previous changes of the financial order, you know, with Britain, there were all these signposts and the same kinds of things where they had excessive debt levels and they had the infighting between the different classes and their military was starting to weaken. And then it wasn't until Bretton Woods, where it was that nail in the coffin. It's like, guess what? You're no longer going to be the center of the financial universe. It's going to be the United States. And then even from there, it was like a 15-year period before the system really worked itself into place. Now, granted, we have new technologies and whatnot, so maybe it's a little bit different now. We can see that trajectory and we can plan, but we don't know the catalysts. And that's why, you know, the whole idea of a diversified approach makes a lot of sense, because, you know, if I knew the timing, as much as I adore you, Randy, I would be owning 5 super yachts. I'd be in the Mediterranean. We would not be having a discussion right now, right? Let's just be honest about that. So I wish I had that, you know, level of foresight, but anyone who tells you they can tell you exactly is either planning to cause the catalyst, which I can be an agent of chaos, but I'm not that chaotic, or they're lying. And so that's the reality and the challenge and the uncertainty that we all hate. Like, we want to know, okay, hey, is this happening like, you know, next year, or is this happening in, you know, 15 years or 70 or 50 years? I don't know. You know, again, history, looking back, it's a short period of time, but in our lives that, you know, could be a much longer period of time. And so it's why you have to keep your eye on a lot of different balls here, unfortunately, and you have to plan for lots of different outcomes. And a diversified approach is good financial advice that somebody would give you in any scenario. It's not something that you're doing that's like, okay, well, this is a really risky endeavor. Things are changing, so now I'm going to ask you to do something weird. It's the same kind of thing. I just think it has a different lens and a different sense of urgency once you really realize kind of where we stand in this historical rhyme, this historical time period, and all the different forces that are coming at you. Because realistically, I mean, it's very overwhelming and we can't prevent the changes of global financial orders, but we might be able to delay them and we can certainly prepare ourselves individually and within our communities. And I think that's, you know, the focus each individual should be taking.
So what are the things people should try to own right now? What's the advice you give your followers?
So obviously, let's put the disclaimer, this is not financial advice. It's not a financial advisor. Go talk to your financial advisor. It depends on your risk and your objectives, all those kinds of things. You want to own things in form factors that you can control. You want to own things that have the opportunity to increase in value. So in the workplace, if you work for a company, you absolutely want to have options and ownership in that company. And it's becoming something that there's a movement, even some private equity firms like KKR are starting to think about this and really reshape it. But a lot of people are like, well, I want to get a slightly higher salary, so maybe I'll trade that off for, you know, shares in the company. No, you need to go into a company, and if you're working for them and you believe in them, you want to be an owner of that. You want to participate in that upside. If you own your own business, obviously that's a way that you can create your own equity value. You can invest in the market in a diversified way to have exposure to lots of different companies. You can own precious metals. I'm an old school kind of person, so I'm more of a gold and silver versus a crypto kind of person. But if, you know, if crypto is your thing, do your research on it, but that might be a solution for you. You definitely want to.
By the way, just I'm going to jump in here for two things. I'm just like you. I'm a gold and silver guy. And two, I thought you handled the cryptocurrency issue in your book magnificently.
Thank you.
You pointed out that it really is based on air at this point. 99% of the tokens and coins are not really, don't even really have a blockchain. And as you pointed out, it's like investing in what you know. how many people could, if they sent you the white paper and said, here is our blockchain, the average engineer, computer programmer can't even tell, is that a legitimate blockchain, right?
I know what a gold chain is. I know what a restaurant chain is. Blockchain,
And so, but you handled it very well to say, you know, hey, even I get Rubani. Am I saying his name right?
Rubini, yeah.
Rubini, okay. Yeah. Amazing book of his about the, with the red balloon on the cover and everything. But even he's looking at, okay, but if we took the blockchain and we actually had something
backed it by gold, right?
Tangible with it, right? And you said, and you know, here's what Buffett and Munger say, but even they bought a bank that's crypto friendly, and even, you know, and it bears to watch, because people don't understand in terms of cryptocurrency, we're in the first inning of a baseball game.
First half of the first inning, probably.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. So there's real possibilities here. Like I got eviscerated because I bought Bitcoin. I did amazing with it. I sold it. I had some other crypto assets. I sold. And so I put it in my blog and just say, hey, you know, I've talked about this in my risky book, but full disclosure, I feel the space is way too sketchy right now. There's no control. There's so many, and I don't trust the exchanges. So I have cashed out everything in crypto, and and people are like, oh, what a clown. You're so full of it. But
here's the thing. So I'm going to point out something that relates to the thesis of the book is that you and I are both in stages of our lives, and we have, you know, made our money, the FU money, and we're in the capital preservation piece of our life. So yes, we can take risks, but we're also very focused on preserving the things that we made, which is a different mentality than maybe somebody who's super young, who I still wouldn't risk everything, but maybe want to be playing around with different things because they have a different time horizon. They don't have the same kind of assets at stake. So that's why, because I, like you said, I'm very neutral on it. It's like, it's not for me, but here are the things to consider.
Yeah. So you handled that perfectly. And sorry, I interrupted you.
Thank you.
I wanted to make that point. Any other things like, in terms of owning, I am one of these people who think you should own your house and pay cash for it. And like Ramit, I forget his name. He's a kind of financial book author or whatever. He thinks that's crazy, thinks people should rent and nobody should own a home.
Everybody needs to own a home. So let me make this case for you. So not only is it the largest asset on households' balance sheets across the U.S., it's the way people drive legacy wealth. And the reason why, as I surmise in the book, is because of duration. When you own a house, you're consuming that house. Maybe your kids are in school or whatnot. You are not looking on Zillow every day at what's the price of my house and, oh, it went down 20%. I better get out of it the way that people do when they're more emotionally tied to something like the stock market. So you ride out those ups and downs and you end up with, you know, an asset of value. Now you have to make sure you can afford it. You should right size it. You should, you know, go crazy, but of course you should own it. Now, going back to our social credit piece, the implications here, because now we're in a time when Wall Street is buying up tens of thousands of houses. This did not exist before 2010. As at the end of 2022, it was more than one in every five homes was purchased by a corporate entity, many of those Wall Street backed. And so now we have a scenario with social credit. What does the government not want you to have in your house? Maybe they don't want you to have a gas stove. Maybe they don't want you to have firearms to defend yourself. You know, whatever it is, if you're now under the rental purview of a corporate entity who is basically a de facto arm of the government, you've lost your sovereignty and your agency. There's a Hebrew proverb I have in the book that, you know, he is not a man who doesn't own a piece of land. You need to own your house. And yes, I know with property taxes, you don't really ever own it, but build up the equity in that home. Yes, yes, yes. Not everyone can pay cash for it, but get yourself into a home. And if you are fortunate enough where you can do the house and also then look at productive land, look at land that, you know, farmland, timber, land that has water rights, ranches. This is what the wealthiest people are doing, because the pricing of that does not have the same level of volatility. And there is a lot of productive use and it's very scarce. And I don't know if you've heard some of the things that are going on, but they're trying to take some of that out of use. So we need more decentralization of our land, and there can be some tax breaks, you know, depending on your jurisdiction associated with that too. So, but things, own things that can increase in value, and whatever those array of things are, the more exposure you can have to different asset classes in a nice diversified balanced portfolio that, hey, if this thing really, you know, takes a crap, maybe I did crypto and that, you know, really, you know, craps out. Well, I also have gold and I also have ownership of this business. So you've kind of protected yourself. Oh, the CBDC comes in and my cash position is, you know, shot, but I can trade with some gold and I have my house locked out. That's the way that you start to create that fortress that they cannot mess with. You want to own things. The elites want you to own nothing. You will not be happy. I want you to own everything.
Others, what else would you tell people you want them to know about this book and why they need to read it?
Well, I think the most important thing is that there are so many different topics that are covered in the book. And there's a very unusual tie between them that I don't think most people, even if you've heard some of the stories, have identified. And you can't come up with these plans if you don't have the base level knowledge. And I think we all have some responsibility to be educating other people. So if you understand something, but maybe it's just at, you know, this level and you don't understand it at this level, so you can't really explain it to somebody else, this is going to give you the knowledge to do that, because we need more people joining this ownership movement. We need more of the decentralization. We need the middle class to prosper. We need the American dream to stay firm, not just for us and for, you know, the heirs that come after us, but for the world. There is no other bastion of individual rights and freedom. Like the countries that are trying to step into the pole position are bastions of tyranny and dictatorships. So there's no like up and coming place looking to step into the pole position. We're like, well, if it doesn't work out for the US, at least there's this place. It's dark. Like it's going backwards if we don't thrive. So that should give us all, you know, those of us who have benefited, like you and I have, Randy, like we owe it to everybody else to fight for this and to make sure that it happens. So if you buy the book, you're going to get that information. You're going to be able to come up with your personal plan. You're going to help other people. You're going to spread the word on it. And this is how we're going to be able to fight back.
So when you're not fighting the forces of evil who want to enslave us, what do you do for fun?
So I'm a big sports person. You know, not only do I work out personally, but you know, I watch a lot of sports. I'm a big football and hockey fan in particular. But you know, if it involves some competition, you know, maybe we might watch it. We consume an inordinate amount of dramas on TV. So like if you ever need like, hey, I need a show to binge watch, my husband and I do that. When I'm in my Chicago location, I play pinball. I have a pinball machine. I'm a big pinball fan. I like to write in all different forms, obviously, but produce a lot of content, hang out with family, eat, laugh, just generally enjoy things.
So you definitely are a content creator in a big way. What's your take? I just have kind of, I declared Twitter bankruptcy a couple of 4 months ago or something. And, you know, I'm on Threads to see where it goes. I do find I'm getting literally 100 to 1,000% more engagement on Threads than Twitter.
Interesting.
But that's, I mean, I have like with 6,000 followers on Threads, I get more engagement than I do with 150,000 on Twitter, because nobody sees your stuff on Twitter. Where are you at on that? Are you still active? What accounts, what platforms are you using? What are you seeing in the space?
So I've always been like a Twitter Die Hard has been the medium for me. I think different personalities gravitate towards different platforms, and different kind of content does better on certain platforms. You know, Instagram is pretty interesting. That's not me. I'm not really good with that. And, you know, I don't have sort of that like, oh, hey, here's a picture of me. You know, like it doesn't. I'm a writer. I'm a humorist. Like, I want to have that kind of engagement. I want to make the quick, you know, quips. So it's been challenging because my engagement has fallen off. Like I used to get, you know, somewhere between sort of 11 and 30 million impressions a month. And now I'm getting 3 to 4 or 5, and that's their reported numbers. So it's not like I'm just guessing this. This is the data that they're giving me. And so
you are on national TV on a regular basis.
Yeah, every week. And so, you know, things that used to get thousands or tens of thousands will get like, you know, 80 to hundreds of engagements, but it's still something. So, you know, I still enjoy it. I still might enjoy my people. I'm thinking about, you know, doing more with a personal newsletter, still playing around with that. You know, I do a little LinkedIn. I kind of hate LinkedIn. It's really weird. I don't know. It's just, sorry for all my LinkedIn friends. I don't get it.
Do a little on Instagram. It's a pretty corporate thing. It's mostly people looking for jobs. You
yeah.
know?
So I haven't really found like I need Twitter to like get its stuff together. Like it's one of those, like I have so much invested in it. It's like an abusive relationship. I can't quite leave the relationship. I'm just hoping that there's like a turnaround here.
You and me both. It was because I'm like you. That was my platform. I built my brand on Twitter. When I looked at social media when it was, and I was like, okay, I think this Twitter thing is going to be something. I'm going to invest in it. I'm going to get on there. I'm going to learn how it works. I'm going to be a power user. At one point, I was, according to a link somebody sent me, and I think it was true, but they said I was the number one poster in the world on Twitter. I had made 50,000 posts or something. And this is years ago. And it really was incredible for me. And I put out a blog and I put it on Twitter and boom, put out a podcast, put it on Twitter, boom. I mean, and it's just, and I love it because I meet people like you. I met Robin Sharma. I have so many friendships that came from Twitter
you curated those friendships, right? Yeah.
I never would have had those relationships any other way. And I, like you, I'm a writer. So I don't want to do the bimbo Instagram thing. You know what I mean? I'm not, Facebook is really... Right. At this point, just for senior citizens who want to look at grandbaby pictures.
Right.
So I just praying that Elon is going to turn this around, but I just don't know if it's possible.
He needs different people in there. That's the problem. Well, first of all, it's a good lesson tying into what we've been talking about is we don't own our social media following. So we've invested in something that we don't own. And so it's not like all those relationships that you built, it's very difficult to pick them up and port them somewhere else. So again, a good thing to keep in the back of our minds. I think one of the challenges is that the group of people that Elon surrounds himself with are very successful tech people who have a different experience in life and also on Twitter. And so they don't understand who the core content creator was. I mean, one of the biggest mistakes I think they made, and you know, this is coming from somebody, you know, not only am I a C-level consigliere, but I've also been in the customer loyalty content game for a long time. That's my other side businesses all relate to this. Taking away the verified check mark was a horrible thing that they did. The people who were top content creators who gave each other scale because they were producing lots of content that people liked, you know, it wasn't just like, you know, random people, but people liked, now all of a sudden kind of got buried and it's, oh, if you pay for it, now you're considered, you know, important or whatnot. And there are different roles on Twitter, right? There's the content creator, there's the curator, there's the commenter, there's different functions and they're all equally important, but they're just different. So taking away the people who are generating the content, that differentiation, and not having a way for that to continue to drive really has limited impressions for everybody. So, you know, that the impressions for everyone collectively has now gone down because you don't have the same big accounts with scale sharing big ideas and having that level of reach. So I think it hurts the entire ecosystem. So I think he would be better served, with some other folks. But I think that he's, bleeding money. I think this whole X thing, he's looking to throw a bunch of things in it so they can take it back public and he can get, some of his money back out of it, because, he overpaid for it. It's been not what he expected it to be. And, so I think we'll see a different public life for this new business. And then Lord knows what's going to happen to it down the road, but I hope it's salvageable.
People like me, when I saw what's working, I said, okay, I'm going to put 2 hours a day into this. And I did. I put 2 hours a day on Twitter because it was rewarding me with that kind of income. People just said, I like this guy. I like his content. I love his, and yes, I would post that. Back then I was doing 5 blogs a week. So every day I would post my blog.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, and then every day I would repeat it in the afternoon. Hey, if you missed it, so twice a day I put a link, and the rest of the time was content. And I engage, I responded, I put up content, and it got, retweeted, it got shared. It
had value. Exactly.
And Elon came to this belief, and it happened before he took over, which was, hey, this person is posting links. They're probably a spammer. Let's suppress their feed. And that was a big mistake. That blue checkmark thing, that was just a hot mess, terrible. And then you got Twitter is the only brand that you could watch American Idol and they'd say, we're doing an instant save. Go to Twitter,
hashtag
Justin. You could watch America's Got Talent. Hey, Twitter, doing it. You could, they
and
would
you
have.
And it. You can't do that anymore. Because they've disrupted the trends. You go on the trending topics. Mm-hmm. I used to be able to tell a trend within 15 seconds and have all of the relevant tweets. Now they've got tweets that are like 6 days old at the top. It's like, how is this a trend? This isn't a trend. This is old news for what Twitter is. So they really do, if they want to have the value, that magic that they had before, which by the way, was disrupted by the previous owner. But when they tried to fix it, they've made it worse.
Yeah.
They need to kind of roll things back and really, before you start adding new things, you have to fix that core product. Because if the core product doesn't work, like I don't care about monetization because nobody's seeing my tweets. Like how am I monetizing this? Right. If I had my 30 million impressions a month, it's very different than my 3 million impressions a month.
Yeah. And to me, it's like as a marketer, it's like, do you know the value of the Twitter brand? And now you're going to throw it away?
That too.
They literally just throwing away the Twitter brand.
Which, by the way, we're still all calling it Twitter. It's like, I'm from Chicago. We still call it the Sears Tower, right? It's been decades. We're all going to still call it. I don't go to x.com. I go to twitter.com on my browser.
But at some point, and I get what he wants. He wants to make it the ultimate payment app. He wants to have the micro payments, the Bitcoin, the Lightning, the everything. Jack started that process. And Elon comes from PayPal, so he knows that world, right? By the way,
his original company, the online bank, was called X.com.
Was it? I didn't even know that.
Yeah, so X.com and Thiel's company merged and they took the name PayPal. But the Elon company that he started was called Online Bank. It was called X.com.
I didn't remember that. But you're right. It was before he went in with Thiel.
Yeah.
And Thiel was the PayPal and that's the one they kept.
Right.
Yeah, so it's just, but it's like Twitter X should love a creator like me. They should love a creator like you.
Yes.
Why are you making us jump through? And I get retweeted.
And I brought it up, by the way. I've been vocal. I hit up their head of product with screenshots of like, here's statistics. Here's what people are saying. Nothing. Radio silence.
When they put the follower the actual views. And remember, that doesn't mean necessarily they read the tweet.
Yeah, it's just it means they
screened through, right? When my buddy is just, he's an Elon fanboy and he just defends everything he does and he thinks it's a brilliant. And I'm like, let me tell you, when he put up these counts of how many people actually read your tweet, it's going to kill him. Because I looked at that and I say, I can't justify spending time on Twitter with that. I need to stick with, I've got my blog. I own that. I've got my email list. I own that.
Podcast, right.
Got my podcast, right. So I'm still hanging out there. I put up stuff now and then because I'm going to, you know, when I do my blog twice a week. So we put that up. My podcast once a week, we put it up. So I want to, since I'm there, I'll try to find some interesting stuff to share and maybe put up a couple more things for me without any links, just to be nice to the algorithm.
Yeah, yeah.
So the algorithms are nice for me. But it's just an exercise in futility at this point. That I mean, I get retweeted by people who have 2 million followers, and there's like, it's seen by 1,800 people.
Right. Well, and you can see the interactions, like you said, the fact that like off of threads that you're getting much more of an interaction base than off of, you know, your big following, it's counterintuitive, and it doesn't help their brand. It doesn't help the Twitter platform. It doesn't help the content that people want to consume. It doesn't make sense. So I do hope over time, as I said, I only share this stuff. I hope Elon is successful. I hope Twitter is successful.
Me too,
So I hope over time, some of the, yeah, and this happens, by the way, in lots of organizations, is that you get the yes men who just, you know, want to kowtow to the person who has the power instead of somebody who's like, hey, the emperor doesn't have any clothes, just needs to tell you that. So he needs a few more of those people in his circle, I think.
100%. I think he's got him at SpaceX. I think he's got him at Tesla. They kind of insulate him from the public there. But Twitter, because he's the chief shit poster in the world, nobody can intercede on his behalf.
And by the way, and that's another mistake, right? When you have a platform that's entire purpose is, you know, content that's created by individuals, it can't be about any one person. Like that, no person should be associated solely with Twitter. And again, you know, it's his, he paid for it, so he can do what he wants, but it doesn't serve the benefit of what he theoretically says he's trying to do. So interesting.
Okay. Any final thoughts you want to share with people out there in the real world?
So I will say, I hope that you will read You Will Own Nothing, and I hope that you will buy a card copy of this, of Randy's books, of the other books that you buy, for a couple of reasons. One, I think just getting in the habit of owning things, you know, it's so easy to go into this digital lifestyle and to get conditioned to, I don't need to own things. Think about the things that you might want to own. Books are interesting because they're going back in and they're changing them, and they're changing future editions, and they're changing digital copies, and they're changing audio copies. If you own this, whatever period of time you bought it, like today, unless somebody comes in with some scissors and cuts out some pages, like this is what I said, your digital copy 10 years from now, I have no idea. You know, it could be shifted. They could say, well, you know, the government doesn't really like you talking about the World Economic Forum, so we took out all the instances of that in the book, but we left, you know, everything else. I mean, who knows? So, you know, get a record of important things and keep those records, because we're going to need them in the future.
Amen. All right, Carol, thanks so much. Really appreciate you sharing your thoughts with the tribe here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks so much for listening. Do me a favor, please, and practice the circulation law of prosperity by telling your friends about the Power Prosperity Podcast. Please like it, rate it, and share. Peace.